Welcome to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is part of our series on Vietnam. As you know, the April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. And during this series of episodes, we've been looking at trying to look more at a personal point of view rather than a political point of view. With politics, you can debate them forever, and as we do so often, get nowhere with that. So today we're interviewing some persons who have been Vietnam vets, and today I'm interviewing a gentleman named Dennis Larson. And Dennis Larson and I actually probably met shortly after you got out of Vietnam, didn't we, Dennis? You were in school for a little bit or something.
Yeah, when I got out of Vietnam, I went to the University of Washington and got my teaching credentials. And right after that, I went to work for the Highline School District, and that's where I met you.
Yeah. The thing that it's funny, I guess, it was, that I remember was that after that first year, you bought that really fancy pickup truck.
Yeah.
Now it's, we're old enough now, Dennis, that is now a classic truck. But how were you treated? Did the people at the university know that you were a Vietnam veteran? Were you treated any differently, or did they even know?
It was quite a transition because I think I was home from Vietnam about a week before I started at the UW. And I think that one of the first things that happened was the anti-war protesters blew up Clark Hall, which was where the ROTC classes were being held. And so I pretty much didn't talk about it.
Yeah. That's interesting. I remember that, too, because that was a guy named Bissell, and that was charged with doing that. And he was pretty wealthy, and he was related to the Bissell vacuum cleaner people. And I remember that was kind of when things were really getting hairy in the universities too, and people were really protesting, and all that stuff was going on. Tell me how you enlisted, correct?
Yeah, well, I got my draft notice with my, with my diploma when I graduated from Washington State University in the spring of 1968, and I thought, I do not want to, I said, if I have to go, I might as well be an officer. And so I actually signed up for officer candidate school, and so they switched me over from being drafted to enlisted, and then I was, also making a commitment of 4 years to the military, which at the time when I was 21 years old didn't seem like forever. But once I got into the military, I found I didn't really like it at all, and I was not willing to do 4 years. But what happened was they said, well, you have to go to OCS. You can't drop out until you've been there for a while.
It's not like dropping out of PE or something, you actually have to.
Yeah, no, there were a lot of hoops you had to jump through.
You couldn't just get a note from your mom and say, I'd like to get out of the military. He has an excuse. So.
Yeah, no, that didn't work.
Yeah. Did you train with the dog? Did the dog already have certain kinds of skills and then you worked with them, or did you train the dog from the beginning?
No, we got new dogs when we arrived in Vietnam. And so we had to go through a little acclimatization process with the dogs.
Uh-huh.
And, it was kind of interesting because some of the dogs were, like your family pet. They didn't have an aggressive bone in their body. And my dog was basically mean.
Uh-huh. Did you have a name for him?
His name was King.
King, that sounds good, yeah.
Yeah, and he came, he was there waiting for me when I arrived, and they said, you know, this is going to be your dog. And, you know, I sent you a picture of me in bed.
Right.
Covered with bandages.
Right.
Well, we were required to take the dog's temperatures about once a week or something like that. And so that meant, you know, putting a thermometer up their rectum. And,
yes.
Some of the dogs would just turn around and look at you and say, what the heck are you doing? And my dog didn't like it at all. And so I almost always, well, I did. I always went out with a muzzle and put a muzzle on them and then put a choke chain on them with a leash. And then I would, you know, insert the old thermometer. Well, one day I was walking out there to do it, and I got about halfway out there and realized I'd forgotten the muzzle. And I said, he's been pretty good the last few times, so I'll just do what they call a hasty muzzle, where you just take the leash and wrap it around his nose and kind of, you know,
hold
it shut. And then, so I did that, and I lifted up his tail and shoved the old thermometer in, and the next thing I knew is he was just going ballistic, and he threw that hasty muzzle off like it wasn't there, and he went right after me and let me know that I was not being very nice to him.
Yes, yes.
And he bit me all over. I still have scars. The scars are still there from that.
Yeah, I mean, I it's kind of interesting when you showed me that picture. You sent that picture. I thought, geez, I didn't know that Larson got hit by shrapnel. But that's kind of what it looked like. I mean, I've seen, you know, some of the other guys that have, one of the guy I went to high school with, you know, got hit by shrapnel and a booby trap, and you kind of look the same way. So King didn't come back home with you to be a family pet then, I guess.
No, nobody got to bring the dogs back. The dogs stayed, and, you know, so maybe if somebody had pull could really get one of them, you know.
Yeah.
But I couldn't.
Yeah.
And I really wasn't wanted.
Yeah, it didn't sound like, yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry King has eaten your brother, you know. But anyhow, you were with the scout unit. And I also, you know, when I showed the picture, I wanted to let you know. You showed me the picture where the dogs lived in the big rubber tires with the galvanized, you know. Was that to kind of protect them, or it looks like they were out in the open. Was that because of heat, too, or?
Yeah, and, you know, those, they were a galvanized arc, you know, kind of with an entrance on each end.
Uh-huh.
And those were sandbags on top of them.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, and the dogs were kept out there. This was in our rear base, which was down by Saigon. And this is where the dogs got all their medical attention and stuff like that.
Right.
And, you know, but, you know, we occasionally got, you know, rocket attacks dumped on us, and the idea was to protect the dog somewhat, you know.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't 100% because if the, you know, the rocket landed in front where the opening was, well,
yeah,
c'est la vie.
Yeah. Did that happen?
Not while I was there, but.
Okay.
I mean, we had rocket attacks, but none of them actually landed in the.
Well, I saw your bunker there, too, and it looked like it was pretty well fortified with sandbags where you were.
Yeah, that was okay. Well, we had two bases, that was the rear, the forward base. Our rear base was just outside of Saigon at a place called Benoit, which is the military base that was kind of protecting Saigon. And then our forward base was up by the Cambodian border. And the dogs could only be out for 2 weeks at a time, and then they had to come back. So we weren't actually assigned to a specific, you know, unit for the whole time. What we were on call, and so somebody would, you know, that was out in the jungle would say, you know, we need a scout dog for about, you know, 6-7 days, and so you would get on a helicopter and you'd fly up to Benoit, and then you would probably get in another helicopter and fly out and join this platoon that would be out there in the jungle, and you'd be out there for about, you know, 10 days on an average, and then the dogs had to come back.
Yeah.
And so then we rotated through, And so, you know, there was, you know, after you came back, you went to the end of the line, and the dogs actually got to rest. And, well, the dogs are resting, you know, you got to rest. And so, and so then you would work your way up to the front of the line again, and then you would fly up to the forward base, and then from there you would, you know, go out into the jungle again.
So you said when you went out in the jungle, so you're there with a platoon or a, you know, group of soldiers. And they, is it that they think that there may be some movement out there or some Viet Cong out there? And so they sent, you said that you had a radio man with you?
Yeah. It kind of depended. Sometimes I would go out with a company size outfit, you know, which was a couple hundred guys. And you would be just trooping through the jungle looking for whatever you could find, and, you know, the dog was out in front with me to let us not walk into an ambush. And then sometimes I'd go out with just a really small recon group of about a half a dozen guys, and then you would go places where, you know, you really weren't supposed to be, according to the officials, you know, like inside Cambodia and stuff like that. And
You had maps and everything and knew where that was, I suppose. And
Oh yeah. And
there weren't signs out there that said, "Welcome to Cambodia," you know.
Yeah. Well, actually, what there was out with a group of six of us, which was pretty dang scary. And, you know, and we were out patrolling, looking for signs of activity along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And, you know, the second lieutenant that was with leading us, you know, he had, for some reason, he had a portable radio, and he was listening to Armed Service Radio Station or something, and Nixon was on the radio saying, "There are no U.S. troops in Cambodia." And we all kind of looked at each other and says, "I guess he doesn't know about us."
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. One of the couple questions I always ask, and one of them is, what was your first impression when you landed in Vietnam?
Well, the airport was under attack as I landed.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and I was thinking, oh, this is not a good start.
That's never happened to me at SeaTac, so I would think that that's, that would not be a good thing at all. When you were out with the dog, was the dog ever in contact with the enemy? Did he ever get that close, or did he just kind of signal and let you know which direction they were?
Well, what he would do is he would be out in front of me as far as he could get with, you know, and stay in visual contact with me.
And he was not on a chain or anything, right?
He ran free. And so he, you know, if he smelled something, which his sense was way better than ours, obviously.
Right.
He would, you know, do kind of an alert pose, and I got so I could read exactly what he was trying to tell me, and, you know, he was good enough so he could tell me if it was just one person or if it was a bunch of people and if they were moving or if they were stationary, and, you know, were they up in the trees or were they down on the ground, and so when he would alert, then, you know, the standard operating procedure was hit the ground, you know. And then, the word came up, well, you know, what's the dog man on the ground for? What's going on? And so I would get the word back to them. And so then, depending on what the dog was telling us, they would, you know, take whatever action they deemed necessary.
Mm-hmm. Did you run into enemies quite a bit of the time when you were out?
Not all the time, but some of the time.
Sure. Yeah. And then you kind of moved back, or did you, and then they kind of...
Once the dog did his thing, then, you know, and then I would move back with the dog, and we would, you know, let the rest of the platoon or the company take over from there.
Did you tell me one time you smuggled beer into the...
Well, remember I told you we had a company of college graduates.
Uh-huh.
And none of us were really, you know, like enamored of military life.
That wasn't what you plan on doing for the rest of your life, yes.
No. And so we had a company clerk who, remember Radar and MASH?
Yes.
Who could, you know, do whatever paperwork was necessary, and you could end up with whatever, you know, you wanted. Well, this guy was that. His name was Don, and he was a master at getting things with paperwork. And so our rear base down by the, you know, by the Saigon was, we had a Quonset hut, which he somehow commandeered, and somehow he managed to get air conditioning for the Quonset hut, and then he managed to get a pool table in there.
Oh, my gosh.
And then he managed to get a cooler, and he said, now all I need is beer.
Yes.
And so he just managed to do the right paperwork, and one day when we were back in the rear areas, he said, take the company truck and go to the airport and pick up the cargo that's coming in. And the cargo was just cases and cases and cases of beer.
What kind of beer?
Oh, I don't even remember.
Okay.
Mean, like Budweiser and Miller.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I did see a couple cans of Rainier there, a few different places. So.
Yeah, it could have been that, too. I don't really remember what kind.
I don't think you, at that point, when you were getting you know, beer out in the field, you're probably not exactly worried. Wait a minute, this is not Heineken, you know? I'm drinking this stuff.
Yeah. Well, so what we would do is, you know, we had this nice setup in the rear area where the dogs had to rest and be medically, you know, treated and stuff. And so, you know, we would be in just kind of relaxing and shooting pool and drinking beer. And then somebody got the idea that, you know, we should maybe get something similar going up at our forward base, you know, up by the Cambodian border, which was, you know, really pretty primitive living conditions up there. We were, you know, living in a hut surrounded by sandbags, and we had the underground bunker right next to us. And so as you got rotated up forward, you would have in your pack as much beer as you could squeeze in there.
Uh-huh.
And so we got that up to the forward base, and it was just enough to kind of, you know, keep the people around us, you know, supplied, but we couldn't keep it cold because we didn't have any way. And so Don says, well, gosh, I can solve that problem for you. He says, they got an officer's club up there. They got ice coming to it. And so he somehow arranged with the local ice plant that was run by the Vietnamese to siphon off a portion of that ice our direction. And so we had this big chest, and about every fifth day, somebody would come and bring ice.
Oh, my gosh.
And the word got out pretty quick that we had this stuff, you know. And so we had a lot of company from, you know, other outfits.
Yes. All of a sudden, you're really popular.
Yeah, we were.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's great. One story I want to make sure that I got you to tell was when I read from your questionnaire, was a story about you went in and you had malaria, and you were in Japan when you had malaria. And how long were you in Japan?
Well, you know, backtrack. What happened, they gave you malaria pills when you arrived in Vietnam, and you took them regularly. And then one day I was out in the field, out in the jungle, and we were exploring a bunker complex of some kind, and the next thing I knew is I was in a hospital in Vietnam, and I just totally passed out and collapsed right out there in the jungle. And somehow,
had you been sick before, or were you feeling crap?
I was feeling sick as we were going through the jungle, but you know, I didn't really know what was wrong. And you know, somehow they got a helicopter in there and got me out of there, and somehow they managed to get my dog back to where it was supposed to be, and I really didn't envy them for that.
So I
woke up in this hospital in Vietnam, and this nurse came and says, you've got malaria. And I went, oh, okay. And so this was a forward hospital, kind of, I think it was in Chu Lai was the name of the place. And so then they sent me to after they got me stabilized, they sent me to another hospital in Vietnam, and I was really, really sick. It was trying to kill me. I was having blood transfusions and everything.
Yeah, your wife was telling me when I talked to her that you were having a lot of blood transfusions, and the type of malaria that you had, it either got over it or it killed you, you know?
Yeah. And so, eventually they sent me to Da Nang, which is the main hospital at that time in Vietnam. And they just weren't having any luck. And they said, we're going to send you to Japan. And so this was, this whole malaria thing took several months at the end, in the second half of my tour over there. And so I was, just kind of bouncing from hospital to hospital. And when I got to Japan, they actually sort of got me stabilized. And so they gave me a fun job, I thought, which was to deliver the mail to the guys in the wards. But I didn't realize that this meant like going into the burn ward and, giving those guys the mail, and going into the amputee ward and giving them their mail. And so the doctors told me, we're just going to keep you here until your term is up, which was in about a month, and said, you'll just go home. And in the process, Nixon decided, as a cost-saving move, he was going to close one of the hospitals in Japan. And so instead of me riding out my last month in the hospital, I got sent back to Vietnam. So I had just kind of arrived, and I was in my bunk bed, kind of while I was asleep. It was the middle of the night, and our lieutenant, who was in charge, he came over and he woke me up and says, "Larson, there's a jeep out here. They want you at division headquarters." And I said, "What?"
What have I done now?
Yeah, I couldn't imagine why they wanted me at division headquarters. And so the next thing I know, I'm trooped in and I'm standing there in front of a general, and I'm going, "Oh God!" So
you're thinking at that time, "I should have never smuggled that beer, and I should have never smuggled that beer."
Yeah, that was probably what I was thinking. I just couldn't imagine why I was there. And he started off and he said, "Well, Larson, how does your father know the Secretary of the Army?" Now, my father was a smelter worker in Tacoma. he didn't know any Secretary of the Army, and I'm going, "Oh man, what is going on?" But I was smart enough to say, "I don't know, sir, but I do know that he knows a lot of people." And
did the Secretary of the Army work in the smelter?
No. What happened?
Yeah.
I didn't learn what happened until I got back home. Is when my mother and father found out that I had been shipped back to Vietnam, my dad decided he was not going to stand for that. And so he picked up the phone, and somehow, which I still don't know how he did it, he got through to, on a Sunday afternoon, and he got through to the Secretary of Army's home phone.
Oh, my gosh.
And the guy's daughter answered the phone, and my dad asked if he could speak with Stanley Raiser, who was the Secretary of the Army then. And he said, the daughter called and said, "Dad, telephone." And so my dad proceeded to tell him what was going on, and Stanley Raiser, the Secretary of the Army, says, "Well, I shall get a hold of people and find out what's the story." And so apparently he called the division headquarters in Vietnam, and, when the Secretary of the Army makes an inquiry, it goes up the chain of command really quick.
Yeah, I was going to say, really quick, yes.
Yeah, and so that's what happened, and that's how I ended up standing in front of the guy. And then he's, looking over my medical records, and he says, I see the doctors say you're not supposed to be in a malaria area. And he says, "Well, Larson," he says, "almost all of Vietnam is a malaria area." And then he looked a little more, and he says, "And I see that you haven't taken either of your two allocated R&Rs. And, your rest and recreation, you got a week's vacation, courtesy of the Army, to go to Australia or Hong Kong or to Hawaii or wherever you wanted. And, well, not everywhere you wanted. They had a set number of places you could go to. And I said, no, I haven't taken either of them. And he said, well, you're taking them both, back to back. And he says, where do you want to go first? And he gave me a choice, and I said, well, I'll go to Hong Kong. And he says, how about second? And I said, how about Honolulu? And so the next thing I knew is I was processing up for a week's vacation to Hong Kong, which I went and did, and got back and processed again for another week's vacation to Honolulu. And by the time I got back from that, it was time to process myself out of there. And so I came out of there and went, you know, I had signed up to go to the UW already. And so I just went right from getting out of Vietnam to signing up and going to the UW and getting my teaching credentials.
And I'm glad you did. And I bet you're glad you did, too. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we had a good time at in Highline School District. And those were good years. And then you were a coach for many years. Did you... You must have been in TRS-1.
I don't know. For teacher retirement system?
Yes, I was. The good one. So that sounds great. And also, I think we're just about out of town. Well, I'm in town. You're out of town. But we're just about out of time. And it's been great talking to you. We need to get together at Matson's or something soon.
Okay, that'd be fun.
Hey,
have you had your shots yet?
I have had my shots, yes.
Okay, good.
And I've had my shots, and I'm past them 2 weeks, so
okay.
I should be good.
Yeah, so are we.
Old age is wonderful. So you take care, Dennis, and have a wonderful time, and I really appreciate taking the time to talk to me, and I'll let you know when these are going to be on the air.
Okay, all right, thanks
so much. Take care. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
To stream any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.